Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
This morning, I was drinking my cup of coffee and listening idly to my husband's YouTube, and he was listening to the interview, and they have one of my favorite authors, one I quote frequently on this program, Michael Pollan, who is a journalist but has done wonderful things around food and around psychedelics and is out promoting his latest book, which is about the nature of consciousness. So he's getting deeper and more philosophical. But I really love his first book. So if you're looking for something unexpected, The Botany of Desire is a wonderful book about coevolution and about how plants and animals, but specifically human animals, are manipulated by plants and manipulate them right back until you have this great chicken and egg phenomenon. And the stories he tells in that book are wonderful and a great introduction to those who are systems-minded to understanding biology and ecology. So I was, of course, quite interested in what he had to say about consciousness. But at the end, the interviewer came back and said, well, we have to ask you what you think about Kennedy and Make America Healthy Again. And, you know, you're a food writer and you made one of the more famous quotes about food, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. And I've always liked another phrase of Michael Pollan's, industrial organic. And one of Jeffrey Bland's that I love is food-like substances. But these are all describing what actually I agree with Kennedy and Maha on, in that we really do need to eat foods that look like they came from a plant or an animal. Where Michael Pollan disagrees is on the proportions and how much saturated fat should be allowed. He frames the Maha blend, if you will, on dietary advice as encouraging lots of meat, lots of beef, and saturated fat. And of course, that's what used to be ironically referred to as the muscular Christianity American way. And Pollan comments about the lack of science on these Maha recommendations for lots of saturated fat. And I would agree with that, except possibly for coconut oil, specifically extra virgin coconut oil, which I've been reading about and have looked up for research. And of the compared with butter, it's much better. It doesn't raise LDL, at least in short-term studies. And I think you can kind of consider that to be the healthy saturated fat or healthier saturated fat. I wouldn't go eating, you know, tablespoons of it every day, but using it for cooking is probably just fine. Michael Pollan ended his segment on the interview saying that he disagrees on the subject of vaccination and many of the other Maha ideas, and ended with saying that avoiding ultra-processed food will not protect you from measles, which was a nice one-liner. But here's where one-liners fail. Here's where memes fail. Life is complicated. Life is not binary, good, bad, pro, anti. Life and people and complex dynamic systems are complicated, nonlinear, and nuanced. So since many, but certainly not all, ultra-processed foods are calorie-dense and nutrient-depleted, they trend a body towards insulin resistance and are pro-inflammatory. And a body that is insulin-resistant and pro-inflammatory is going to have problems with immunity. So perhaps not eating ultra-processed foods doesn't protect you from getting the measles, but maybe it makes you less likely to get very, very sick from the measles. And there's an ugly, it just brings out the whole, you know, eat meat, be, you know, eat meat kind of thing, especially in the face of the ecological consequences and the vast, I mean, meats and AI centers, right? These are the large energy sinks that we're throwing tons and tons, kilotons of energy into at a time when we should be trying to live on less energy in order to continue to have a habitable planet. It's just crazy. But there's, I call it social Darwinism that's embedded in the Maha thinking. It goes something like this. I'm strong. You're not. So it's really wasted altruism to help you by funding vaccines or social welfare programs or anything to help you. I believe in bootstraps, not uplift. And, you know, that's great until you're old or you break your leg or something else happens. And then, yeah, you need those things just like somebody with a disability needs them. And it's just bullheaded and wrong is a simple way of putting it. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be effective in many ways. I want to talk about a candidate for Surgeon General that I feel is completely unqualified. And it makes me feel sad because she's a woman and I like to support women. But we're talking about a residency dropout named Memes. Her full name is Casey Memes, and surprise, she's an influencer. She's a graduate of Stanford Medical School. Good start. But she dropped out of her residency in 2018 because she could become a wellness influencer. And she did. She also helped launch Make America Healthy Again. So a little payback there. And she's done a number of dodgy things. But the thing that bothers me is that she's a Dr. Oz. She hawks nutritional supplements and accepts fees for doing that. And she's encouraged people to buy her glucose monitoring device, that she gets a piece of every device and she gets paid for that. That's unethical in a physician giving advice. It's just unethical, okay? You can't do that. Maybe you can do that if you're a dentist, and maybe you can do that if you're fill in the blank, a lawyer, a supermarket, but you are ethically prohibited from doing that level of, here, I have just the thing for you. She's also been a vaccine skeptic, and she is getting her Senate hearings, and I'm really concerned because I'm thinking about all of those people who basically lied, including Kennedy, during their Senate hearings. Those Senate hearings are not fact-checked, and people, and believing the testimony that people give, just take a look at the Supreme Court and what they said in their hearings and what they did with abortion, and you'll get my point. We cannot afford to have a wellness influencer as the Surgeon General of the United States. We need someone who is clinically experienced, who has leadership experience, who knows science and actually thinks it's real, and who isn't dancing to the beat of the latest trending trend on pick your social media. We have to keep our public health institutions and research centers intact. We've already gutted a lot of the research with just the funding cuts that happened earlier this year. But we have to get off this clown car. And the only way to do it is for the Republicans to step off the clown car by simply saying that this person's too incompetent. Yes, Mr. President, I know you, I know you want this person in office, but I have concerns that this might affect your standing with the public and your chances in the next election. You got to get him where he lives. But really, honestly, this one worries me. This from this email came in Saturday night from Lou in Switzerland, and I always love getting the international ones. It gives me it That is, to me, that's my version of the thumbs up sign. I actually get the little dopamine pop from that. The thumbs up leaves me cold, but a letter from Switzerland from someone who heard my show, yeah, I like that. Okay, I'm reading Lou's email now. I was hearing a podcast that popped up on my feed, and the doctor, not you, exclamation point, spent 10 minutes hawking supplements and private memberships. How can I trust their advice without thinking of their own self-interest? And then I thought of you. Never selling, never promoting, just offering sound advice. Thank you. You provide a real service to the worldwide community. I also have an update. Years ago, I wrote you about severe hay fever. I also have a histamine intolerance. You suggested trying an elimination diet. For me, this didn't work, but I have found a program that does lower my risk of reactions. So we're going to be, I'm parenthetic now, we're going to be giving you the signs of histamine intolerance in just a moment. But during hay fever season, I stay away from cross allergens, that's like apples and cantaloupe. So again, parenthetically, if you're allergic to pollens, certain pollens actually have similar markings, similar barcodes to foods, and often they're related to the trees that grow the fruit. It's important that you cross-check the cross sensitivities. If you know, if you get, let's say, allergy tested at your allergist and he says that you're allergic to ragweed, there are foods, off the top of my head I couldn't tell you, but it's easy enough to search, that cross react with pollen, and you want to check the pollens you're allergic to because you want to avoid those foods, especially in the hay fever season, because you'll be adding more pollen to your pollen burden and you're already having trouble with that pollen triggering an allergic response. In the case of Lou, he has histamine intolerance, which means that wherever the histamine is coming from, whether it's coming from food being broken down in the gut or fermented foods, or whether it's coming from his own mast cells reacting to something, he's going to have a hard time getting rid of that histamine, which means he'll have larger symptoms. And in the gut, those symptoms can be cramping and diarrhea. So Lou continues, year-round, I avoid any aged meat and products and all shellfish. Fish, lower in histamines, are okay as long as they were processed quickly. And why does he say that? Well, if fish sits, the bacteria that are on the surface of the fish can start fermenting a protein, an amino acid in the protein of the fish. And this amino acid is called histidine. And the similarity in name is no mistake or coincidence. Histidine and histamine are very similar. The only difference is that histamine has an amine group, which is an NH3 group. And that is it. And that's an easy thing for a bacteria to convert. And in fact, there's actually a syndrome where fish is infected with a certain bacteria that just really breaks down all the histidine, and people get a histamine reaction as if they were having an anaphylactic attack. It's a big, big bolus of histamine, and it can make them very sick. And this in people who've never had an allergic reaction because they've just flooded their body with this stuff. In addition, Lou says, I try to avoid yeasty fermented foods like wheat beer, wine, blue cheese, and breads with a high yeast content. This pretty much works. A game changer lately has been to take Daosin before meals. Daosin, by the way, is a brand name version of diamine oxidase, which we've discussed before on this program. N-methylhistaminase is what's in your blood, and that breaks down histamine in your blood. Diamine oxidase, hear that A-S-E on the end? Molecular scissors usually have A-S-E on their end. So if you hear that in reference to the name of something biochemical, you can be sure that it's breaking down something. So diamine oxidase basically breaks down a diamine, and that diamine is histamine in the gut. And where is it coming from in the gut? Well, it's coming from your microbiome, and it's coming from foods that that were fermented by a microbiome, but outside of your body, aged meat products, again, external fermentation. And it's a real bummer to have to eat around those things. So I'm very glad, Lou, that you've found that DAO is helpful for you. We've talked about, and I want to thank you, Lou, because we've talked about histamine sensitivity or histamine intolerance a little bit in the program, but you've inspired me to put together a longer segment. So I will say to my audience, the next month I'm going to be very busy creating and teaching a functional medicine course for a medical resident who wants to really drill down in functional medicine. Very excited about that. But that's going to take up some of my free time. So this segment will be produced and appear probably in April, unless something disastrous slows that down. So moving on with news, I have a good news of the weird for you. Just think about it for a moment. It makes sense, but I found it hilarious, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Scientists have found a source of powerful antibiotics that could protect children against common respiratory viruses, reports New Scientist. The substance? The blood of pediatricians. Researchers screened blood from 10 pediatricians who had worked at Children's Hospital of Chongqing Medical University for over a decade. They found 56 potent antibodies against respiratory syncytial virus, which infects almost every child by age 2. Three antibodies proved particularly effective, neutralizing a wide range of RSV strain, and one of those also blocked human metapneumonia virus. Tests in mice and rats showed that pediatrician, I love this, it sounds like a commercial, pediatrician-derived antibodies were up to 25% better at blocking RSV than existing treatments like nicivimab and clesrovimab, and protected against more viral strains. Visit a pediatrician near you and ask for blood. No, I'm kidding. But it does have that quality. The findings make sense, given that these doctors build up resistance through constant exposure. In my first 2 years, I would probably get 2 or 3 notable respiratory illnesses per year, said Australian pediatrician Trent Calcutt, who was not involved in the study. Now I can go a year without getting anything. So I will say that my experience as a doctor in training paralleled that. My first year as an intern, I was sick literally constantly. And then I discovered the left-hand rule. You've heard of the right-hand rule in electromagnetism. Well, the left-hand rule is elevator buttons, banisters, and doors, door handles are touched with your left hand, because if you're right-handed, you're going to touch your face all the time and scratch your eye and do all sorts of things without even thinking about it, but you'll do it with your right hand. So keep that puppy off the doorknobs and let your left hand do the twisting. Between that and just the natural accumulation of antibodies in my body over time, I am also, you know, like most experienced family physicians and pediatricians, fairly bomb-proof for getting illnesses with respect to the light exposures, the short-term exposures that you get going into a room with a sick person. It's quite a different situation if you're a parent, because then the level of viral contamination in your household is so high that the first time you send a kid to daycare or kindergarten, you can count on being more or less sick for the next year at a low level. It gets better with subsequent children, and practice makes perfect. So we all have a ways to go in improving our immunity, getting enough sleep, making sure you have good nutrition. These are key as well. Keeping those vitamin D levels up, also very good. We're heading into sun time, and now that we've had our time change, there's more sun in the evening. Get some sun on your skin if you can, and that will help you. All right, on to our next story. This about microplastics, another scary microplastic story, and I'm going to again use this as a platform to talk about critical thinking in science and how you need to think about other explanations. Researchers have found microplastics inside prostate cancer tumors, raising questions about whether these now ubiquitous particles play a role in the disease. In a small study of 10 men, all right, your alarm bells should be going off, small study of 10 men, and they don't mention a control. So scientists compared samples from prostate tumor tissue with non-cancerous tissue from the same prostate. Okay, there's your control. That's cancer. We'll compare the plastic content of the cancer tissue with the non-cancer tissue. And they found an average of 2.5 times more plastic than the non-cancerous, about 40 micrograms of plastic per gram of tissue. This was very surprising and concerning, said lead study author Stacy Loeb. Well, lead study author would say that, and they were telling the NBC News, so yeah. This is definitely something we're going to continue studying further with more cases. Because similar studies of microplastics in humans have been criticized for possibly introducing microplastic contamination in the lab process, like plastic is everywhere, the study authors were rigorous in eliminating plastic from their methods. If anything, this might have been overly conservative. And then last sentence here, very important. Why should you care? Over the past decades, cases of late-stage prostate cancer have shot up more than 6% in men over 55. Okay. So that is absolutely true. Let me give you two counterfactuals, one of which is cancers grow faster than the surrounding tissue. They grow extra blood vessels so that they can grow faster. Faster growing tissue is going to have the opportunity to incorporate more plastic. And so more blood equals more plastic because the plastic's in the blood. Are we sure that that's not the reason rather than somehow the cancer being caused? I mean, why else would the cancer sequester plastic? And the answer is probably just more circulation. What about the other one? Over the last decade, cases of late-stage prostate cancer have shot up more than 6% in men over 55. All right, so we have to think, okay, what else has happened in the last 10 years? Oh, yeah, we stopped checking PSA because let's see if I can get it right. It's a terrible acronym, and I can never remember exactly, but it's the United States Health Sciences Health Prevention Task Force Survey or something along that line. And basically, they look at, is it worth doing this test? And what they came up with, and I sort of agree with it when you're talking about epidemiology and taking an utilitarian look at should we be testing for prostate cancer, they said, you know, mammograms, sure, improve the survival curve. Colon cancer screening, sure, improve the survival curve. Fewer people dying of the disease. Prostate cancer screening, no. Part of the reason is the screening is invasive. Basically, the PSA is not invasive, but you have to do the biopsy because most elevated PSAs are not cancer. So how do you figure it out? Well, until very recently, we did biopsies, which meant we took a needle and poked holes in the prostate. Okay, infections, bleeding. You're going to have a certain number of complications, mostly in older men. So you're basically rocking the boat in an older person. Never a good idea. I mean, I am not certified in geriatrics, but I could probably take the exam and pass it if it was offered to me, because you learn, you read the books, and you know, you don't rock the boat in older people. You cut the dose on the medications. You expect there to be more interactions. The system is not as resilient as it was when they were 35. So we stopped doing it because we seem to be doing as much harm as good and zeroing out the benefit of PSA screening. What does that mean? Well, let's talk about Joe Biden, right? The president of the United States, you can reasonably expect that he was getting state-of-the-art, by-the-book, per-all-recommendations healthcare, which included not getting not getting PSAs. And so he was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer, diagnosed late, probably could have been picked up when he was running for president. And yet we weren't testing. And we weren't testing because we were told it doesn't do any good. And on the average, it doesn't. But if you happen to be the person who got the late diagnosis of prostate cancer after it's no longer operable because your doctor did what they were told to do, which is to stop doing routine testing. Well, that stinks, doesn't it? That's the reason that late-stage prostate cancer rates have shot up 6% in men over 55 in the last 10 years. You don't need to worry about microplastics. You've got the explanation staring you in the face. Should we have done it or not done it? Was that the wrong thing? It really depends on whether you believe that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of a few. I believe that is a quote from Star Trek, so probably there's an entire graduate's course about that, but I'm going to leave it there. However, I did get an email. I'll go with this one quickly. Dear Dr. Dawn, you talk about microplastics. What can we do about the microplastics already in our bodies? Well, first of all, not much. They seem to be incorporating themselves in our flesh, and we can't exactly go in and scoop them out. We really don't have a good way of filtering them, and they're pretty invulnerable to all of those AZs, those molecular scissors I was talking about, because we don't have any molecular scissors designed to chop up plastic. So we kind of have to hope that they just sit there and don't do much. And whether they do much is really not established. I'm going to quote a study. This is probably considered the best study for showing a correlation. I want to emphasize correlation, an association. It was done in the New England Journal of Medicine, came out in 2024, and they looked at people who had asymptomatic coronary artery disease. They hadn't had a heart attack, but they screened out. Probably this process went something like they got a stress test. It was abnormal. They got an angiogram. That was abnormal, showed a blockage. So they underwent a procedure to remove plaque. And when the plaque that the researchers found buried in the arteries of their patients was they had more microplastics. What they found was the more microplastics you had, the higher your risk of heart disease, stroke, and death over the next 3 years. And this was probably, I'm not looking at the original article, I suspect this was probably mostly carotid plaque that they were getting. But, you know, I would be willing to bet that carotid plaque and a coronary artery plaque are about the same. But the problem is plaque, inflamed tissue, which is exactly the kind of plaque that's going to cause a stroke or cause a heart attack, it's inflamed. It's going to be rapidly building itself, and it's going to incorporate whatever is around, and that would include whatever level of microplastic is in the blood. Whereas plaque that is not growing and is just sitting there is less likely to rupture because it's had time to harden up, and literally harden up. And so the one that breaks is the one with the microplastic. And so statistically, people with microplastic in their plaques are more likely to have soft plaque. So you see that the causality just isn't there yet. And I just want to, you know, give you a couple of pointers about microplastic and just minimizing it. And I had some thoughts about water filters, and I'll start with that. What about water in bottles, and what about your filtered water pitcher? The filter's not a problem, it's charcoal. But what about sitting in a plastic bottle? What about the plastic bottles that you use to go and get your purified osmotic reverse osmosis water? I mean, you could be buying the best water, but if you're storing it in the plastic, is that okay? And the researchers are all over the map. Sometimes they come up with a lot of detectable microplastics in filter pitchers, sometimes not at all. Actually, probably not a big deal unless you have used that bottle for hot water, if it's been exposed to heat. Don't use it again. If you've microwaved it, God help you. Don't microwave stuff in plastic. Of the foods that you might possibly choose to eat that you think are okay, I'm going to target prepackaged nuggets that are breaded. And that could be breaded shrimp, breaded chicken, even the plant-based healthy nuggets that Quora and other companies make contain a lot of microplastics per serving. It's because of all the processing that goes into creating the slurry that then gets breaded and fried. So every time you run something through plastic tubing, guess what? And pink Himalayan salt, right? That healthy salt. Terrestrial salts like pink Himalayan actually have more microplastics than salt that come from aquatic sources like sea salt. And, you know, after I started reading about microplastics, I was like, brushing my teeth, and I'm like, oh, those are plastic bristles. Well, you can buy boar's hair bristles, but not any that fit on the ultrasonic toothbrush. And I'll tell you, if you're worried about inflammation and early aging and oxidative stress, you're more worried about bad teeth than you are about plastics. I will point out that you can get floss made out of coconut fiber. And I use that for other reasons, not related to the plastic. So what do I advise for this? I advise use your plastic toothbrush, use your plastic floss, then spit, then rinse and swish and spit again, and you will have eliminated those plastic fibers or microplastic fibers in your mouth before they go down the hatch in the first place. Let's go back to our next story. So we covered the microplastic question. Now we're going to talk about a rather surprising bit of information important to all women, and most of you either are one or know one that you would like to keep alive. So let's talk about an unexpected benefit of mammograms. It turns out that mammograms can also help identify unsuspected coronary artery disease in women. It goes something like this. Remember what I was saying earlier about how plaque in the carotid arteries is essentially the same as plaque in the arteries of the heart, or for that matter, arteries of the leg, or for that matter, the arteries of the breast. And calcium, talked about plastic depositing in plaques. Well, calcium likes to deposit in plaques as well, particularly inflamed tissue, so inflamed plaques. Radiologists have noticed little calcium deposits in the arteries woven through the breast tissue for a long time. But we weren't able to really use this incidental finding. Researchers used AI to quantify the calcium deposits in arteries of more than 120 breast cancer screening scans and found more breast artery calcification was a marker for increased risk of heart failure, heart attack, stroke, and death. And this is done on the database of large hospital and outpatient groups, things like Kaiser and other groups have lots and lots of longitudinal data. So they know that they saw the breast calcification in 2020, and they know that that person had a heart attack in 2024. But there's lots of factors, right, that compete, but they have that information. So they could, for example, look at cholesterol levels, smoking, coexistent diabetes, all of those big risk factors, and you could equalize the groups and control for that It's called a risk-adjusted model, and they used PREVENT, which is the latest and the greatest calculator for predicting risk. And what they found was if you have, this is all compared to no breast artery calcium. If you have a little bit, your hazard ratio goes to 1.32, not very significant. If you have a moderate amount, then it goes up to 1.75, close to doubling. If you have a lot, it's 3.3 times greater. So what would make a lot of sense would be for us to do take all of these mammograms and run them through a sort of risk calculator. Now, women, young women, are starting, they start to get their breast, their mammograms at about 45 now. And we could pick up those women who already are high risk for a heart attack in their 50s. This could be really valuable. It's calculated that by 1950, a third of women between the ages of 20 and 44 will have some form of heart disease. And that's based on the increase of cardiovascular disease in women. Now, some of that may be increased surveillance, like case finding, we call it. But nevertheless, it's a very scary bit of information. Between two women who looked very similar in terms of all their other attributes, the cholesterol, the risk factors, their age, their race, those in the severe category of calcium had double the risk of a cardiovascular event. And there's actually a product out there. Have we got an app for you? It comes from a company called Cure Matrix, and it's been cleared by regulators to do exactly this, detect and score calcification in mammograms. But it doesn't have the history to be covered by insurance, and some clinics are offering it on a fee-for-service basis. If you want it, you have to pay for it, but we've got it. And the problem with that is it's going to be reassuring to people with the money to identify that, but that's probably a group that sees their doctor regularly and may even have already had a stress test. Whereas the group that I'm most worried about are the people who struggle for access to healthcare but do get their mammograms. And if we can identify high-risk heart disease in that cohort and address it, that's where we're going to really move the numbers in terms of early cardiovascular mortality in women. And as you might imagine, I'm very much in favor of moving those numbers. This is another platform, you know, news grabber item. A couple of little points really quickly. First of all, this is not a peer-reviewed science study. It was released this month at the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons annual meeting. It was drawn from electronic health records in one of those large national databases, 150,000 patients. And remember, large numbers create statistical significance. Large numbers magnify small differences that aren't really meaningful clinically. What they found was that over 5 years of using GLP-1 drugs, the risk of osteoporosis, that is to say on bone scan, was 30% higher. The risk of gout went up 12%, which, by the way, really doesn't make sense because you'd think that weight loss would actually reduce your chances of gout. But the risk of osteomalacia, which is basically calcium poor bone. In adults, it causes osteomalacia and bone pain. In children, it causes rickets. But it's basically because people eat less. It's common sense. You change your diet when you're taking an anorexic agent, which these drugs definitely are. You eat less and you consume less calories and lose weight, but also you consume less vitamins. Less cheese, less ice cream, less vitamin D. So the osteomalacia, which is what happens to adults with vitamin D deficiency, I totally believe. The problem with this data is it's not peer-reviewed, and we have reason to believe it's true, but we don't know that it's true. And so I feel that I need to poke a few holes in it just on general principle. The group also highlighted tendon injuries, an increase of, or 5 years of, several type of tendon ruptures. And one thing, and I think this definitely bears looking at, pectoralis tendon ruptures. Now, that I've never seen that injury. I've seen Achilles tendon ruptures. Those are fairly common. They usually come from jumping off a wall or something where you really forcibly flex the foot. Pectoralis tendon ruptures, when they do happen, are usually like a heavy bench press. And at least this researcher reports that patients are having, you know, trivial force, like pushing a door open and getting a tear. And he also notes an increase in rotator cuff injuries. So I'm interested in this because it turns out that the drug companies actually knew about the tendon weakness. They already knew about it, and they are busy developing drugs that combat the loss of tendon strength from their other drugs. God, what a win-win for Big Pharma, huh? So, is it worth it if you're diabetic, if you're morbidly obese? Absolutely. Do we need to know more? Do we need to keep studying the effects of these drugs? Strong medicine has strong side effects, and we're just beginning to have enough people on this stuff for a long enough time to start to see emergent things. And like I said, I believe the osteomalacia, by the way, the risk ratio, 12% for gout, 100, the hazard ratio, or rather the increase in osteomalacia was 150%. And that's a rare disease. And if you got 150% increase and you find an associated factor, you need to sit up and take notice on that one. I'm not telling you, if you are in a group that needs to be on GLP-1 drugs, not to stop them. Don't stop them. But definitely make sure that your diet is good, that you take extra protein, that you take extra vitamin D, and that you avoid high impact type activities like jumping and bench presses. As far as that matter, maybe not such a great idea to be powerlifting with those pectoralis muscles until further notice. So, some bad news for all those longevity influencers out there. Latest paper based on data from human twin studies concludes that genetics account for about 55% of variation in lifespan. This is actually far higher than early estimates. The team reached the new figures by separating deaths caused by external factors, such as accidents, infections, and environmental hazards, from deaths driven by, quote, internal biological processes. We used to say he died of natural causes, but you can't put that on a death certificate. So what do you put on the death certificate? It's an open question. And how? And is it truly the cause of death? Well, that's another open question. The 55% figure actually has some external validation in that it matches previous estimates for the role of genes in physiologic traits like height, body fat, and muscle build. So twin studies on pretty much anything, you get 50% genetic influence. But not all influences are genetic. Your dad affects your health in a really interesting way. How fathers behave with their babies may shape their kids' physical health years later. This is physical health, not mental health. Penn State studied videos of nearly 300 families who agreed to be recorded interacting with their firstborn at 10 months and then 24 months. They found that fathers who appeared warm, responsive, and developmentally supportive at the earlier 10-month stage were more likely to have a cooperative, low-conflict co-parenting relationship when the child was two. That's kind of a big scientific duh, but blood samples, dried blood taken from the children at age 7, and though it found that those with more attentive fathers early on had lower levels of inflammation and, get this, better blood sugar regulation. And here's where it gets really weird. Mother's warmth in parenting was not linked to the same outcome. No one is surprised to learn that treating your children appropriately and with warmth is good for them. But it might surprise people that a father's behavior before a baby is old enough to form permanent memories can affect that child's health when they're in second grade. And then along the same lines, but sort of in the opposite direction, another study, the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, tracked 2,887 grandparents with an average age of 67 between 2016 and 2022. What they found was that those who were actively involved in childcare, from playing and preparing meals to helping with homework, consistently performed better on cognitive tests. Non-caregiving grandparents saw their memory scores fall more sharply over time, while caregiving grandparents experienced only modest declines. A similar pattern emerged for verbal fluency, measured by how many animals participants could name in 1 minute. The benefits, which were more apparent in grandmothers, appeared regardless of how regularly the grandparents helped out or what kind of care they provided. So being a caregiving grandparent seemed to matter more for cognitive functioning than how often they provided care or what exactly they did with their grandchildren. I think that there's some interesting stuff in both of those about how your external dynamic, the people around you, have a big, big effect on your dementia. And here's more to support that. There are several science-based ways to lower your risk of dementia. Exercise, walking, socializing with others. But in one study, it found that this was a study done actually quite some time ago in the 80s at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine. And they set out to better understand the aging brain by looking at 500 men and women ages 75 to 85 living locally in the Bronx, because that's where the College of Medicine is. They underwent neurophysiological tests and responded to questionnaires about their health and lifestyle and cognitive testing, and they were tracked over a couple of decades. For every cognitively challenging activity performed 1 day a week, there was a 7% risk reduction in dementia. The more often people tested their brains, such as with board games or crossword puzzles, the less likely they were to develop Alzheimer's or vascular dementia. But when it came to physical activity, one hobby stood out far head and shoulders above the others, dancing. Physical activities such as swimming and walking trended in the right direction. But the dancing, people in early stages of dementia may cut back on dancing. So that's why the study was designed with a very long period of observation to sort of try to correct for this. And we know that that dancing is aerobic. We know also that it's social. It's music-based movement. And because you have to listen to the music and coordinate the motion, it's very much like the other two activities that in scientific research have strong anti-dementia benefits or dementia prevention benefits even. Those two are learning a new language, because when you learn a new language, you use your mouth and lips differently, and you're bouncing between the language center and the hearing center and the motor center, so lots of crosstalk in the brain. It's the crosstalk, however you do it, that seems to be the big thing for helping the brain rewire or stay properly wired and not have those wires erode. The other one is learning a new musical instrument. And again, music uses a part of the brain that isn't otherwise exercised quite so much. And playing a musical instrument is definitely a motor activity. You're maybe sitting still, but your lips and fingers and mouth are doing unusual things in some combination. So social dance-based activities also reduce your risk of falling by as much as 40%. That isn't a surprise. It's going to help for balance. If you want to become a dancer, There are dance classes at community centers. I would encourage those. But if they're not available, there is a whole world of dance, of online dance classes out there. And there are also video games about dancing and that get you doing the movement. And maybe you're more interested in something that can be competitive. Whatever will get you to do it. And the magic amount that seems to come through in all of these studies is about 3 hours a week is enough to see observable change. And it doesn't matter whether you're using one of these many rehab programs that have sprung up to try to help people with head trauma and head injuries or strokes. All of those are legitimate, but they have to be done enough. 3 hours a week, that's actually not too bad. I think most of us could find 3 hours a week if it held the promise of staving off our risk of dementia. And it also probably is just plain good for you. And that is where I'm going to end it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.